the only thing that makes sense to my brain is to put myself in a room with people that are way better than me. It challenges me. It makes me work really hard. And it keeps me focused on developing my craft. Forcing myself to be in an uncomfortable situation makes me adapt.
Welcome to Nashville Drummers Podcast, episode 47.
Today's featured guest is Alec Parrish, who is a touring session drummer. Moved here a few years ago from the Georgia area and is best known for not only being an Ableton designer and coach and a killer drummer, he's been recently out with Alana Springsteen.
Super handsome. And we also talk about coffee and imposter syndrome, both things that I'm very interested in.
And many other topics, yeah. No, we kind of started going into his recent gigs with the CDC Festival with Alana Springsteen over in Europe. I just loved his attitude of like being prepared under duress, and when things go wrong is what you need to really land these bigger gigs. And that was a big takeaway for me. Yep.
Great fella, great talk. And special for this episode is some Patreon-only content.
Yeah, during the conversation with Alec, he describes a certain fill that he played and is actually credited on the record on the song Runaways by Daniel Bradbury. And it was a fill that impacted the song so much that during the recording with legendary Nashville drummer Jerry Rowe.
Hope to have you on soon, buddy.
Yeah, man. She actually played Alec's live version of the fill and said, you know, I want something like this. And so we partnered with episode 25 guest Tim Buell, the transcription wizard. And exclusively for our Patreon subscribers, he's transcribed both of the fills. So the fill from the recording by Jerry Rowe and then the fill that Alec played live. You can download the PDF transcription. You can also read a brief write-up from Alec just on his process and how this experience went. Visit patreon.com/Nashville Drummers Podcast for just $5 a month. And we hope to offer more benefits like this in the future. So thank you for the support.
We hope you enjoy episode 47 of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. Maybe they will write about you. Maybe I was wrong about you. My sister warned me about guys like you. Maybe I should think twice. Maybe they will write.
Yo, this is my first podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm not a on the mic kind of guy normally.
Well, what's cool about this whole thing is it's not... I mean, the mics are here and like, don't try to dodge them.
Yeah.
But we're just hanging out and having a conversation.
Every once in a while, you'll probably catch me just like looking down and making sure I'm on axis.
Yes.
Like, oh God.
I just like, I keep catching myself in these conversations, remembering that it's a podcast.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, it's a podcast.
I'm like, I just want to like hang out and have a conversation. And that's, it just kind of naturally goes to the places that it should go, because that's, I feel like that's what I want out of when I'm listening to a podcast anyway. Right.
How you been, man? I haven't seen you in a while.
I know, yeah. I think we met at Barista Parlor, right?
Yeah.
Coffee? Ooh. Yeah.
Mm. Coffee Ableton chat.
That's right. Yeah. I've come a long way since then.
Yeah, man. Yeah,
I've been digging in and...
Looks like you've been getting a lot of work.
Doing a masterclass here, apparently,
hell
in a few weeks.
Dude. Let's go, man.
Got to still put that together, but...
That's amazing, man.
Yeah, you've inspired me. So oh, thank
get
you.
Out of here, dude. Like I've been teaching anything recently. Come on. Come on.
Well, let's just get into what you've been up to. So sure. You've been over in Germany drumming with Alana Springsteen.
Yeah,
right?
Man.
How has that experience been? And more importantly, how has the cuisine been?
Ooh, gosh. Yeah, I just got back from a quick trip to Europe. It was my first time over there. We flew into Amsterdam. And I actually passed out on the flight on the way there, like medically passed out.
Whoa.
It was the first time it's ever happened in my life.
Were you dehydrated?
I was very dehydrated. Yep. And I got like really hot and flushed and went to the bathroom and like rinsed my face off and like sort of passed out on the way out of the bathroom. And a flight attendant was like, hey, are you okay? And I woke up and was like, yeah, I'm good. And then they were taking the trash thing back and I was three rows back. So I only had a little bit of distance to get to. Couldn't make it.
Wow.
Fell on the floor.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was fine, but like they were just concerned and they were like, do we need to take your blood pressure? And I was like, I'm fine. It was the most embarrassing thing in my life because I'm one of those people that is very proud of my travel efficiency. So, yeah. And like I was, I on the road with Alana, I'm kind of like acting day of TM. She has a company here in town that does her production advancing and tour advancing called Good for Show Productions.
Okay.
And so when I'm on the road with them, I kind of work with some of their other clients, but with Alana too, music directing, drumming, playback, and then also day of TM coordination. So being the guy that passed out on the flight was a bad look for me on that day.
Yeah, you're supposed to, you know, have
I'm
it all together.
To be taking
yeah.
care of everyone exactly, else, and yeah. I'm the one that needed help.
But, yeah, they had to stick you with an IV and everything.
was the whole band like right there? Like, could they all witness this in real time?
My buddy Josh plays guitar with Alana, and he was like on the front row right next, and he was like, "Oh man, somebody just fell down." And then he was like, "Oh, that's Alex."
Oh no. That is an incredible story.
Yeah, so that was how we started.
That's how
the trip.
We started. Yeah,
we landed in Amsterdam a couple hours later, and I was fine.
And this was the C2C festival,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so we did some full band stuff for C2C, but the main C2C festival is like, what is it? London, Belfast this year, and
there's a lot of them.
There's three main locations, and it's like the same bill every night, but they just like rotate.
Oh,
so there's three main festival locations.
Yeah. I feel like this whole past month, my entire social media feed is like
everyone who's on a big gig
has been in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, it was crazy.
I hadn't heard of that festival. So it's country to country, right?
Country to country. Yeah. So C2C. And then now what's going on in Australia is CMC.
Okay. Yep.
So now
Neil Jakobin just flew
exactly,
over there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Smith,
Nate's
I'm sure
over there.
A bunch of other people.
But basically like half of the C2C festival people are all flying over to Australia right now to do an extension of that.
They should have just stayed there. Vacation, right?
I know, man. It's summer down there right now. Well, I guess it's technically fall, but, it's opposite seasons. And then that trips me out every time. We were there in November, like beginning of November, I think. I was there with Danielle, another artist that I work with, and it was the beginning of summer. Dude, Sydney at the beginning of summer, nothing like it.
I bet.
It was next level.
But also like on the critters front.
Dude, I had the same thought. I'm not a critters guy.
Yeah.
But we're in the city there.
Sorry, Brandon.
Yeah.
Brandon's listening to this and he's like, oh man.
It's just, yeah. I'm a little intimidated of Australia any time in the summer, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, for Sydney, I'd be into checking that out.
Sydney was great. We also went to
Sydney
Melbourne,
so cool.
And the coffee scene there, unreal. Just so
really?
Good. Yeah. Oh dude, coffee in Australia.
Does it put East Nashville to shame?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Turns out Australia puts East Nashville to shame.
Man, you learn something
title
every day
card
in this podcast.
For the day. Oh man.
How many shows did you play, and like what was kind of like the day to day, week to week like for you?
In Europe?
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
For this festival.
I played two shows.
Just two, okay.
Two shows.
Cool.
And it was the same thing for when we were in Sydney last year too. I played two shows and then came back. But yeah, we flew out Thursday afternoon, arrived in Amsterdam Friday morning at like 8 a.m. Walked around all day in Amsterdam. Had a team dinner that night that was incredible. The food in Amsterdam was next level. And then Saturday, we went down to Rotterdam, which is about an hour south, hour and 15 south of Amsterdam. And we hung out there. We were playing direct support for Paisley. So like that was awesome to see Ben Caesar play. And like, it was cool, man.
Yeah.
It was really cool. But the people in like the Netherlands were just like the kindest and happiest people in the world. They were so stoked to have us there. So they were taking great care of us. But yeah, I got on site and Alana had already been over there with her manager. They had been in Berlin the night before doing like an acoustic show because like part of the C2C festival is like the Bluebird Cafe presented by a local venue. So it was kind of like a traveling Bluebird Cafe.
Oh, very cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. So she was there the night before. So she went Berlin, Amsterdam, and then back to Berlin. So she was all kinds of jet lagged. We were all hurting, but she was definitely hurting worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we did Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and then the next morning we got up and basically the whole festival flew or took a train if they didn't have to be there early. Mm-hmm. So we flew over to Berlin, played that show that night, and then the next morning flew home. Wow. So it was a turn and burn, but yeah, it was,
as it always is, right?
Yeah, man, it was incredible. I was talking to a buddy the other day and he asked me like, what was my favorite show or what was it like? And you know, we only played two shows and they were both incredible.
How long were the sets?
We played for 70.
Okay.
Yeah. So a decent chunk.
Yeah. That's great.
It was awesome, man. And like, it was kind of a surprise for me because I just thought we were just playing on the festival. I didn't think we were doing like direct support for Brad Paisley. And then we show up and it's like, yeah, we got a 70-minute set. Like we're going to rip through this right before Paisley. And it's like these massive theaters that are almost like arenas over there. So it was like 4,000 cap rooms and it was like every seat was full. The floor was just slammed.
That's sick.
Like it was dope. So we get up there and we start playing and Alana loves to do this thing where she just like gets in the crowd. She loves to be like with the crowd. So yeah, at some point in the set, she's going to end up on the floor or like she's going to make like a really intimate moment. And so for these shows, there was either like a thrust that went like straight out into the middle of the room, or there was a stairwell that went off the side of the stage. And so first night she went and sat at the end of the thrust and just was like right in the middle of this room. She sings a song called Amen. And it's just like her and our keys player, Daniel. And the whole room is like lit up with like their flashlights on their phone and stuff. And it's just, yeah, it was just nuts.
It's a cool moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second night when she did that, she was still on the main stage, but she was like sitting right there and she had everybody get their lights out. And I'm like creeping back onto stage. It reminded me of like church, like prayer moment, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We started creeping back on stage and she's like singing the last chorus of her song. And I just like look up, and in Germany, there was definitely a language barrier. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, I'm hearing all these people sing in English. And I'd had some like trouble communicating with some of the stage hands earlier in that day. But then like I'm getting up on the stage at this moment, I take an ear out and I'm listening to the room, just kind of sing back with her, and all the lights are up in the air. And there was a photographer right behind the drum riser on like Paisley's set. And they're just like taking a photo of the room. And it's the photo that Alana ended up posting from like the Germany show.
Yeah.
And it was just like the most surreal moment of my life being across the world to play drums for 70 minutes, two nights in a row, in a country where most of the people can't speak English.
Yeah.
Or just didn't speak English when I was communicating with them.
Yeah. But still a bunch of them are singing everywhere.
Yeah, man. It was wild. It was,
that's insane.
It was the most,
that's a very specific and powerful connection.
Yeah. It definitely was a moment for me that kind of brought me into what I was doing. I feel like I played a better show on the first night, but on the second night, I think I like really took in that moment and was like, holy crap, man. Like this is what I dreamed about doing when I was younger. And like, it's happening.
That's so
like,
cool.
It's so wild.
Let's go, so man. Wild, man.
Like we say, you know, music is a universal language.
Yeah.
And it's cool to hear that you like actually experienced that in person.
Yeah. It was wild. I loved it.
So cool. I haven't seen an Alana show, and I know it sounds like sometimes a lot of these artists that kind of like, you know, are very energetic, you know, they'll sometimes go off script and maybe kind of leaning into like the Ableton and music directing role. Have you had to sort of adapt like in real time during those sets, or does she run a pretty tight set where it's like, here's the transitions and it's going to be the same cues, you know, every song?
Yeah. I mean, Alana's a pro. She's like 23 years old, dude. She's young.
Wow.
But she's been studying of like her idol people and like people that she respects to like get the tightest transitions possible. And she really takes feedback really well. So like if she has somebody that's like a music director or a production coordinator or a performance coach or something like that, that's like, hey, you need to say this here for 16 seconds. She's like, all right. And she starts a timer.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? Like she's the kind of person that will like get what she needs to say and feel it every night. And then that's what she does.
And that makes your job easier, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. Because a lot of times we'll have, you know, timed transitions, whether there's a loop going or if it's like a actual built-in track that's just like an interlude section or something like that in between songs, or if it's like, okay, cool, we're playing the progression four times through, she's got it. You know, she's paying attention to where we are in the progression and how many times we've looped it. And then she builds her transition conversation off of that. Mm-hmm. So it makes my job easier because I don't have to worry about her getting off the rails.
Yeah.
But I have a failsafe, obviously, because sometimes things happen.
Yes.
And she gets excited, or any artist, you know, gets distracted by what's going on in the room or something like that. And, yeah. You know, there was a show that we did at the end of last year. It was my second show on the gig. And we're playing Joe's on Weed in Chicago, which is one of the coolest rooms in this country. And she has this moment in the set where we just have this loop, this indefinite loop, while we play the intro to the song called Cowboys and Tequila. And she gets someone from the crowd up on stage to take a tequila shot with her. Or like she'll have like the opener come out and take a shot with her or something like that. So we're doing that and we're just vamping. And she always goes, 1, 2, 3, cheers. And then takes the shot, you know, hugs whoever it is.
Sean Ford. Yeah, on the one.
Exactly. So I'm like trying to line it up perfectly. Again, second show. So still, you know, no rehearsal, kind of was called in last minute for it. Second show, we're in the loop. And then she does the 1, 2, 3 cheers, takes the shot, gives the hug. And I was like, all right, cool. Here we go. Into that progression, triggered it forward. And then it does the intro one more time, and then it does the verse count. She was given some pretty low-grade tequila that night. So it burned a little bit more than normal.
Yeah.
So she needed a second to get some water.
Okay.
And so we launched into the verse, and she missed the cue. And so we just kind of played it off, kept going. And fortunately, I have that show striped so that it went, you know, every section there's like a marker. Mm-hmm. So with that verse being the same progression, all I had to do was just line it up to where it was like, you know, right before the end of the first progression, I'd like called it into a talkback mic and triggered us backwards into the verse. And she landed it.
Wow.
So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah. Oh, dude, she's a pro. She's a pro.
But so are you. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm hearing a story of multiple pros, not just her.
You're saying all this, and some drummers are like, well, I don't know what he's talking about. Yeah. And maybe we'll get into that.
I can pull up a graphic and we can superimpose it. Green
man,
screen.
Man, but to have that experience on your second gig, that must have been, it sounds stressful.
It was just like a oh shit moment. And then afterwards it was like, okay, cool. We can all do this together.
Yeah.
We're all riding this train together.
Yeah. Isn't it a great feeling when you pull something off? Do you ever, after a moment like that, just go, I'm pretty good at this?
Like, it's more of a F yeah.
Like, yeah.
We landed that
one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just curious. I would be absolutely screwed. I know nothing about Ableton.
Really?
Absolutely. I am just, I mean, nope. You don't. And technology malfunctions around me. So I'm not running the laptop. I mean, my wife can confirm to you that things that should work and I am using correctly just simply don't work in my presence.
Yeah.
So that's not happening for me. But have had moments where I'm like, oh, well, we kind of nailed that together, didn't we?
Yeah.
We're pretty good at this.
It's a great, right. It is a great feeling.
Yeah.
It is. Obviously we don't want anything to go wrong during the show.
Right.
But, when things inevitably go wrong, it's really good to know that you're like in it with the boys and the rest of the team, and everyone's like, okay, cool, we're gonna find the solution.
Yeah,
and we all thought of it at the same time. Here we go, we're moving in this direction.
Great. I love it.
That's the best. You guys know Mark Poise?
Yeah,
I don't think I know Mark.
He's a super pro drummer. He's out with Tyler Farr, another Ableton guy.
Yeah.
I took a recent lesson with him, and he has a whole course that we'll probably promote on this podcast here soon. But his notion is like, if you're only good when the circumstances are, you know, pristine and simple, that's great. If you can play a great set and you're prepared and everything's working, but that's like not quite good enough to be that professional. Like what happens when things go wrong? Then are you going to fall and crumble?
Yep.
And during the lesson, I told you about this. It was so cool. I'm playing a track and then he like undoes or Yeah, he like took my hi-hat stand away. Mm-hmm. He like undid the clutch. He turned the snares off.
Wow.
To see how I would react.
Wow.
He unplugged my headphones to make sure like things that could actually happen on a gig, right?
Yeah,
that's cool.
And that's how you practice, right? I mean, yeah, just reminded me of that.
Man, I had a friend when I was kind of coming up. So I'm from Athens, Georgia. And before I moved to Nashville, I, you know, went to school at the University of Georgia. And the whole time that I was there, I was playing at
Bulldog.
Go Dogs. Come on. The whole time I was in school there, I was playing at this church that is a partner church of the North Point Community Churches in Atlanta. So it was called Athens Church. And I started playing in like the middle and high school services when I was in high school. And then in college, I did a lot of Sunday work there, whether that was the adult services or middle and high school stuff. Like I was just very plugged into that community because they were super pro musicians and I was not. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very green and was playing with tracks, was playing with clicks and stuff. But like I was a punk pop kid and I had a very busy right foot. and so I had a couple mentor figures that were there that were just kind of like, hey man, like this is what it means to play with Pocket. This is what it means to like listen to other people on stage and not just focus on yourself.
Serve the song, right?
Exactly. Kind of yeah. And so I started cutting my teeth with that. So taking things away from the kit. Yeah. So I had a buddy of mine that was a monitor engineer that really started to test me when I got really comfortable at the church. And he was like, every once in a while, he would just pull the click fader down in my mix.
Oh, good man.
Yeah. To test my time. Yeah, and
exactly.
He wouldn't do it to anyone else. But that really like changed how I listened to the other people on stage because, you know, everyone needs to, I personally believe that everyone needs to have a little bit of click in their mix just so that we're all glued.
Yeah.
But it's obviously most important for drummers and, you know, bassists to have click. So as long as you have enough of them and just a tiny bit of clicking guide, like you can, you can limp through stuff. Mm-hmm. But my big thing was like, I would always lock in with the bass players. I was focused on learning how to be more pocket. I was like really trying to pay attention to what they were playing. And so whenever he would start just gradually pulling that click fader down, I would just look over at him and he'd just have this big shit eating grin on his face. And I would just look at the bass player across the other side of the stage and he would look at me and he would know exactly what was going on. And he would just stand dead still.
Yeah.
He wouldn't move. He wouldn't give
He's
me
not giving you any signals. Anything,
dude.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it really made me work on my timing. It really made me work on my feel for the rest of the team. And obviously he wasn't doing that to like hurt the rehearsal.
He was doing it to help.
He was doing that to help, probably to mess with me a little bit.
Yeah. But
he was definitely, you know, just having some fun with it. We normally did that during like soundcheck before the 5:30 or something like that. And it was always like, oh, we're close enough and there's the click back in your mix. So don't get lost. but it was a fun exercise of like, okay, what happens if things go down?
Or yeah.
What happens, you know, we were using Motus at that point. What happens if the Motu connection gets loose, which that is a notorious problem with Motus. That's why I don't use them.
This episode's sponsored by Motu.
This podcast no longer sponsored by.
You're right.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we often talk about like, you know, the greatest mentors and teachers push you.
Yeah, right? For sure.
And yeah, and that's so applicable, especially, I mean, back to like the hardware stuff, like how many times have we all played gigs, I'm sure in this town where it's a shitty kit, you know, and this, the hi-hat stand is malfunctioning.
Yeah.
Like, is that going to throw you off?
Oh my God.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, man, I had
a game. I mean, it shouldn't, but a lot of times it does. If you're
bass
not,
drum, the bass
not
drum
prepared.
Is creeping. Hey, yeah. Where's the sandbag? Oh, we don't have one of those. Oh, crazy. Cause this is the house kit and this creeps every time I touch it and you haven't got a sandbag. Yeah. That's insane.
This is too real for Nate.
Yeah. That's like just straight up
tapped
insanity.
In, dude.
It's our subject.
My God.
Oh man. Yeah. I commonly, the things that most happen to me with hardware malfunctions are, my hi-hat pedal slides a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a 2-leg DW hi-hat stand. So it gets away from me pretty easily.
Yeah. God help you.
And then,
gotta get that 3-leg.
My rack tom is on a flat based snare stand.
Yep.
And for some reason, the like locking mechanism on the basket that gives it the pivot point, for some reason, every time I put that in the case and put it in the trailer, the next day, if I don't crank it down, it will fall. Like the basket will just tip. Huh. And there was one time I was on stage and I was on a 4 foot deck, like 4 foot drum riser. I sit pretty high on the kit. So like my rack tom has to be pretty high too. So if this thing toppled, it was going to be 6 feet minimum to the deck. And it was a brand new kit.
Oof.
Brand new. And I first song of the set intro, and hit the rack tom in my fill and it just goes,
oh no.
And then comes back. And I look over at our monitor tech playback stage manager guy. And I was like, help, please. He comes running over and he was like, what's wrong? And I was like, I don't care what position it's in. Crank it.
Yeah.
Just keep it from moving.
The look over. Yeah. Something is wrong here. Please help.
I've seen that before. And what I'm afraid, my friend, you have a case of a haunted snare stand.
Oh yeah.
But it's also obvious that you also have a case of guardian angel. Mm. So it's kind of counteracting each other.
Perfect.
So you should be fine.
That's ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it to keep me on my toes.
Yeah. It's just enough to spice things up. Oh, that's scary. You'll be fine. As long as you get help real quick, you'll be fine.
Yeah. And then I also have the, like the boom arms. Sometimes those guys will either the end of it will fall and I'll have a cymbal just like on my rack tom, or it'll like rotate away from me. And that's not fun.
That's my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Well, are you guys using those ball and socket ones?
No, I'm using mostly DW hardware right now.
Okay.
But yeah, again, if I'm not paying attention to it every day after the trailer, it's just, it's like a roll of the dice every time.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, all those details you got to check beforehand. Yeah. And like, yeah, back to the lesson with Mark, he was like, we did a checklist of all the things that you should have in a gig. And he's like, where's your second snare? I was like,
dang.
I've never brought a second snare to a gig. Even for a local gig, like, yeah, I've never done that. And he's like, well, what if the snare wires break? Are you prepared? Yeah. You know?
It's,
I'm not. Well, I guess the gig's over, guys.
Yeah, that's it. So on most of the gigs that I'm working on right now, I have, you know, primary snare and a side snare and then a backup.
Okay, there you
go. So when I show up to the gig, I have three cases of just snares. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry.
This guy.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have options at all times.
Yeah.
Circling back to the Alana stuff, the first show that I did with her, again, I didn't have a rehearsal beforehand. I was just kind of jumping in to finish out the last 2 weeks of her headline tour. And we threw all my stuff in the trailer. We loaded up the van. We drove up to Iowa. And then we got into our, you know, first show and we do sound check. And she was like, hey, you know, like I love your snare, but I don't know if it's right for like what we're going for. Do you have, you know, other like options or things that you can use to kind of change the tone? And I was like, yeah, I've got a couple things
in my pocket. Yeah.
And we tried a bunch of different stuff and then I ended up just like A-B-ing it with like the one that I had in rehearsal and soundcheck and then the other one. And she was like, oh, that's the one. And I was like, that was what I was doing.
Oh my gosh.
It sometimes people have this like thought of what they think it should sound like and they just want to hear you change it.
Yeah.
It's like the monitor engineer.
Or they listen with their ears.
It's like the monitor engineer that's like, let me turn that up for you. And they just move their hand and you're like, that's perfect.
Exactly. Sometimes you just have to mess something up to find out it was right the first time.
Yeah.
Like, and that's just it. You just have to, shift your perspective, which is, you're like, okay, well, let me hear the other options. Oh no, that really was the best.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. How do you get the perfect Nashville kick drum tone? It starts with a Lowboy Leather Daddy bass drum beater. This leather-faced beater occupies the sonic space between felt and wood beaters. It's punchy enough to cut through the mix on those four-on-the-floor barn burners with the warmth you need for slow ballads. Okay, but who plays a Leather Daddy? Garrett Goodwin from Carrie Underwood's band uses one. Lee Bryce drummer Donnie Marple plays a pair. Walk down Broadway any night of the week and you're going to hear one. In Nashville, you can test drive a Lowboy beater at Drumbox and grab one at Forks, Drum Supply, or Nelson's. Check out lowboybeaters.com to learn more.
So let's back it up a bit. I mean, how did you first get connected with Alana? And yeah, like, I want to hear your journey. I don't really know your background of moving here from Atlanta, right?
Yeah. So I went to school in Athens at the University of Georgia, was really involved in the music scene there. Did a lot of the church work. I mentioned that a minute ago. But I, you know, played in a couple different bands when I was in college. We did like sorority parties and frat parties and some shows downtown, and then played in Atlanta every once in a while. But after college, I moved to Atlanta and was working at like North Point churches down there, primarily like Buckhead Church, right in Atlanta, which was awesome. It was such a great experience. Again, leveling up in terms of like who I was surrounding myself with and people that were super pro, in my opinion, and challenged me to just be a better player. So it was great to work with those guys and the teams in Atlanta. But I knew that that gig was really comfortable, and I was like 22. Mm-hmm. It was like 2 or 3 days of work a week, and I was making a living doing that. And it was great. It was great money and great, like, comfortable accommodations. They gave you great food. I could sleep in my own bed. It was awesome. But I really wanted to challenge myself when I was younger to go and experience something that I probably wouldn't have done later in life. So I moved to Nashville and really wanted to focus on touring, and like was cool with indie touring, like wanted to just get in the van and go. I used to tour with a friend of mine, like out of my own personal car, you know, before I moved to Nashville. Mm-hmm. But that was like, okay, cool. This is what it's going to be like. I'm ready to go.
And what year did you officially move here?
I moved here in 2018, I think, May of 2018. Yeah, this is coming up on 6 years.
Yep. Pre-pandemic.
Pre-pandemic. Yeah, so.
Pre-Morgan Wallen bar opening this summer.
Did you just plug Morgan Wallen?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was down there last night for Whiskey Jam.
Oh man,
You're the one that sidetracks us. But is there just like Morgan Wallen music playing now, just outside, just
probably
on repeat? I swear there is.
Well, yeah, like everywhere I go in life.
No, but like on the construction site, I swear.
Oh,
just like,
oh, that's hilarious.
Like, really, who's paying for this?
He's getting paid. Dude. Yeah, he's getting paid no matter what. Doesn't matter.
I think it's just the roof of.
Every bar
around
town.
Whiskey Row.
Yeah, yeah, right.
They're just got the DJ set going on up there all the
anyway,
time.
Anyway,
yeah. Morgan Wallen. But yeah, so I moved up here and started to focus on like making connections. There was a lot of previous Atlanta cats that had moved up here and gotten some really cool gigs. Like Christian Pascal plays drums for Marin. He's been with her from the beginning. Sam Bedingfield plays bass for Kelsey Ballerini, and like he was an Atlanta guy. His brother Nate's up here too. He's done a handful of incredible gigs. Like lots of people to look up to from the Atlanta scene that had moved up here and gotten on these really cool gigs. And that was kind of, those guys were the first wave of Atlanta people that were like, okay, cool. These guys know how to play with tracks, and they, you know, they're super pro. They know what it's like to be on massive IMAG cameras and screens and arenas and stuff. So let's get them on these tours. So like they're landing people left and right, like Thomas Rhett and stuff like that. So I was like, man, I want to get up there and do some tours like that. Yeah. I've got some friends that have made
some good connections. Right. To have in your corner, and so to look up to.
I moved up here and I wasn't expecting anything, but I was like very hopeful that I was going to be just assumed that I was going to be in the same rank as those dudes. Absolutely should never have thought that.
But I'm from Georgia too.
Yeah. I'm from Atlanta. Yeah. These are my friends that I played with in Atlanta. Cool. but I moved up here fully expecting the experience that I had developed in Atlanta to kind of be my weight, when really different city, man. It's a totally different city and it's a different beast. Sure. There are tools that you can like develop and hone by being in a pro scene in a different city. But ultimately, like the way that you land a gig is by being here.
Yeah.
You got to be present to win. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. Going out, meeting people.
Exactly.
Being known.
Yeah.
Right.
And so for the first year of me being here, I was trying to make a ton of friends, but I was also like trying to connect with the people that I knew from Atlanta and the people that they knew to kind of establish myself as like the second wave of people moving up here from Atlanta or whatever generation it was. So after about a year, I hadn't gotten anything major. I had done some stuff in town with some friends and, you know, some other gigs had come and gone and dried up, but I started to like get a side hustle, was working at Pinewood Social, which is now just Pinewood.
Oh, they changed the name?
I think it's just Pinewood now. Yeah.
When were you working there?
I could not even tell you. 2019, maybe. Were you there?
No, I was wondering if I only went there one time, and I just wondered if you were working.
I was
there
a host, so okay. You would have seen me right when you walked in.
Okay. How long did you stay?
I think like 4 months.
Okay, probably not. I don't think I was here, went there until at least 21.
Cool. Anyway.
I think you would have remembered him versus the other way around.
Yeah, I would have scarred you for life on my way in. Yeah.
No, I mean, as long as you weren't a screaming bachelorette because I didn't seat you for brunch in time, then I would have remembered
the reservation.
Kindness. Yeah. No, man, that was a fun job. I met some incredible people when I was working at Pinewood, but a lot of that opened up my perspective of like, okay, cool. I can make friends outside of the people that I thought were going to, you know, kind of help me get work here. Yeah. I can really focus on like fostering relationships.
Real friends, yeah.
Yeah, and that really made a difference in how much work I got and broadening my scope of like what I want to do and who I know in this city. Like my goal when I first moved to Nashville was to use this as like a stepping stone, like a lily pad to jump from one place to the other.
Yeah.
So I went from Athens to Atlanta, Atlanta to Nashville. And ultimately my goal was to end up in LA because I never listened to country music when I was growing up. I never listened to country music until I was here. Mm-hmm. And then it was just for work. It wasn't like, oh, this is the music that I consume for my own personal enjoyment.
Right.
It was I have to learn this for my job.
Yeah. And this is the gig.
Yeah. It's the gig. So ultimately, I wanted to end up in LA to play music like super pop music, like Lauv and things like that. But I got to Nashville and really fell in love with the city. I fell in love with the people and the community. I've lived in East Nashville ever since I moved up here. And I didn't want to leave. So I was like, man, I gotta figure out how to like country music. but it was cool because I had my little like niche of being the Ableton guy. And so I really started to cross into the pop scene in Nashville when I was working at Pinewood. So I met a lot of like top line writers and I met DJs and just people that became really good friends of mine that were pop artists. And so then I started to hang out with them and go see shows at Exit Inn and, you know, the Cannery Ballroom stuff and meet a bunch of other people. And that just became more like that was just authentic networking instead of like, hey, here's my business card. And I was like, oh, hey man, this guy can hang at a show and is just a good dude to be around. Like, that was
exactly. Yeah, I'm available 2 to 6.
Yeah, exactly. but that was a turning point for me. So I started to like hang out with people that I was working with at Pinewood that were also doing music, obviously, because they live in Nashville. And they were creative and they didn't have to be music people. Some of them were like graphic designers or photographers. And it opened up this entire other door to this city that I was completely blind to before I got here.
Yeah.
And then after about a year, a mentor figure of mine, who's a really good friend of mine, his name's Tom Wall. He's an amazing drummer. He's been out with Jameson Rogers for years now. Before that, he was with like Cassidy Pope and a bunch of other people, but he's a producer and songwriter here in town too. But he and I met right before I moved to Nashville, and I was sitting at the airport in Atlanta, getting ready to fly out to Denver to see my brother. And the girl that I had been dating for 6 years and I were supposed to go on this trip together, and we had broken up like a week before this trip. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there trying to get on an earlier flight and I couldn't go. So I'm just sitting in the Atlanta airport by myself, hanging out. My friends are sending me like Venmo and Cash App stuff so I can go to the bar and just like chill.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Delta Club?
Oh,
at
yeah.
That airport? Yeah. It's
oh, yeah.
Sick. Yeah. That's their hub.
Next level there, dude. Yeah. There's like 10 of them, you know, in every terminal. They're everywhere.
That's insane.
But I'm sitting at the bar in Atlanta airport just like scrolling through Instagram, and I'd been following Tom for a little while, but I'd never met him. And I saw that he was going to be in Denver with Cass, and I DM'd him and was like, "Hey dude, totally random, but I'm also going to be in Denver. Do you want to get coffee?" And he was like, "Man, I don't have time to get coffee, but if you want to come to the show, I'll put you on the guest list and we can have a beer there and just kind of catch up." And I was like, "That sounds awesome."
What a response. Yeah. It's like probably a better answer.
It was way better, dude. Way better.
Sorry, bro. Consolation prize. Do you want to come to the show for free?
Totally.
VIP backstage access or coffee.
It was great, man. It was awesome. But we ended up catching up at the show and talking a lot about what I wanted to do when I got to Nashville. It was like a month before I was going to be here too. Okay. So it was like perfect timing. And he was instrumental in introducing me to his friends, because he had been here for like 8 or 9 years at that point. So he was like very, very pivotal. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Pivotal. Mm-hmm. Just felt weird saying it. You know? He was very pivotal in introducing me to people that were on that higher tier of gigs and stuff like that. So I remember being at his birthday party a year later at his house with a handful of his friends that are now people that I am close with too. But they, you know, the main thing that I remember about that was the first night that I met a guy named Daniel Shiflett, who was Daniel Bradbury's band leader at that point in time. He was playing guitar and band leading for Daniel Bradbury. And so I met Schiff and I was just like, "Oh, what's up, man? He's funny. He's a good dude. Loves NASCAR." He had his daughters with him, or it might've just been one of his daughters at that time. I don't think he had two. But Daniel and I connected, and then, you know, I didn't see him again for a couple months. And then I got a phone call from a songwriter that Tom had plugged me in with, to do a last minute show for like the 4th of July or something. And the songwriter ended up putting me in a group text with some number, and I texted that number to Tom and I was like, "Hey man, do you know who this is?" And he was like, "That's Schiff." I was like, "Okay, great." And so Schiff and I ended up on the same gig, no rehearsal, 45 minute throw and go, tracks, sample pad, three piece. just
throwing in the pool.
Yeah, man, just swim. Throwing me in the deep end.
Yep.
So we get there, we do the show, and it ended up being amazing. It was a great time. It was a great hang. We drove up and drove back the same day. And I was like, "Okay, cool. Like, working with Schiff is really fun. I enjoy being on stage with this guy. I enjoy hanging with this guy, especially." And 2 weeks later, he calls me and he's like, "Hey man, Danielle needs a sub for these two shows in June. Are you available?" And I was like, "Yeah, man, I would love to." Keep in mind, this is like a year after I was here in town.
Yeah.
A year and a half maybe. So it was my first major label artist that I'd worked with. It was a private event and then something else that I can't even remember, but it was the biggest deal in the world to me to be given that opportunity to show up as such a new young guy.
Yeah.
I was like finally putting the pieces together of like, "Okay, cool. I really worked on doing something and getting good at my craft before I moved here." Yeah. And now I'm getting that opportunity to like work with people that I was like really excited about working with before I got here.
Yeah.
And so we played the shows with Danielle, and the first show that I played with her, as soon as we got off stage, you know, it was like a private event with Michael Ray. You know, we're standing side stage while the hands are like pushing the drum riser off the stage. And she comes up to me at the monitor desk and she was like, "Dude, I fucking love the way that you hit the drums." She was like,
"Yes."
She was like, "You crush the drums. And I really love that. I want somebody on stage that has that energy, but also the power that you bring. And I really, really enjoy working with you." And I was like,
"Man, cool." To get that from the artist, yeah, I mean, that's right, pretty
but
rare.
Like,
right?
As soon as I got off stage,
how did you feel as soon as you heard that?
I was like shook.
Yeah.
Completely, completely stoked, honestly. Like the fact that, you know, we had spent the morning like driving down in a Sprinter van. It was in Alabama or something like that. It was in like Huntsville. And so we drove down day of in a Sprinter and we had like talked a little bit, but like didn't really connect, didn't really know much about her. She definitely didn't know much about me. And then we had this show and it was amazing. We got off stage, everything was great. And to hear that, I was just kind of blown away. Wasn't expecting anything like that. Was just kind of expecting it to be like a, "Hey, good show, man. But yeah, for her to be so intentional to be like, this specific thing that you do is what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Which means that, and not to the detriment of anybody, it just means that that wasn't something that she was really experiencing all that much before. Because if you're taking the time to exclaim about it.
Yeah. Well, man, here's the thing. Yeah. There are some incredible cats that have been on that gig before me.
Right.
So it's not to say that any of those people weren't delivering that. Right.
But it is a taste thing and a personal thing. Your touch was what you wanted.
I think it is kind of like you can put six chefs in a kitchen and give them the same recipe and you're going to get six different dishes.
Yes. And six incredible chefs with like, it will be the same, different, all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. I'm not going to name the name, but I saw a very, very well-known drummer, 100% you know who this guy is, on a gig. And I was like, oh, cool. He's on this gig. Mm-hmm. So pumped. Hated his feel. Mm. Hated it. And I was like, interesting. I really, really prefer the other guy.
Yeah.
They're both great. But for my taste.
I think I have a feeling I know who you're talking about. We'll connect with this later.
If you guess it, I will be blown away, but I'll be so pumped that you did. Anyway, yeah, we'll go back to that. We'll talk after the mics.
We'll get Nate's free pork pie snare drum if you guess it right.
Hey.
You start giving away your gear on this podcast.
I'm not using it. Whatever.
Yeah. Dude, I can totally relate because I've been on both sides of that where it's like I've done some sub fill-ins and it's like I play great, but maybe the artist is like, yeah, you know, good gig and I'll call you next time.
Yeah.
And nothing against my playing, just like there wasn't that like, oh my God, you were really, really great. Like I'm going to specifically comment on that. Mm. But I've also had that where the artist is like, no, like you were just so on it, you know?
Yeah.
And that just feels so much more rewarding, fulfilling.
Yeah, right? Man. It was the beginning of a long run and a career of, or a lot of firsts of my career with Danielle. Yeah. I played on my first major label cut with her. I did like it was funny, man. During COVID, there were like, she was scheduled to do Stagecoach, but they canceled the festival, obviously. So they did this thing called Stage Couch. So they had like a radio broadcast and it was like two songs, or three songs from every artist that was supposed to be at the festival. And me, her, and my buddy Jess Grommet got in a room and just did like, you know, Jess?
I love Jess. Dude. I haven't seen him in years, but I love that guy.
He is the best.
He is such a
good dude. He was on the gig with me with Danielle for the first 2 years.
Dang.
Yeah, he played that first show with me there, and it was his like third show with her. And it was just like one of those moments where we were all vibing, and he's just the most tasty guitar player.
Yeah, and he's such a freaking sweetheart. I love that. I need to reach out to that guy.
You should.
Yeah.
He's the best. But yeah, so the three of us got in a room, and Jess and I kind of engineered a recording for the three of us. And I was like playing a sample pad with a shaker, and Danielle was singing. Jess was either playing keys or playing guitar. And we just did two or three songs and submitted that for the thing. And then afterwards, the label was like, hey, we really like these records. Like, we should put this out as like an acoustic thing. And so her management approached Jess and I because we engineered it, and Jess mixed and mastered it. And they were like, hey, can we just like get this remastered? Like, we don't want to mix it any differently. We just want to get it remastered for like an album release. And we kind of text each other on the side, like, is this happening?
Yeah.
Is this for real?
Yeah.
So I got my first engineering credit, which I would not call myself a record engineer, but I got an engineering credit for that. And then I got my first drum credit on a major label for that.
Very cool. It was sick.
Yeah. And then last year, Danielle put out a couple singles, and one of them was this new song called Runaways. And when she got the demo back for that song, we started putting it in our live set, and there was a fill that I did one time that she just like snapped her head around in rehearsal, and she was like, that's it.
Okay.
She was like, that changes the entire.
I was going to say, that could be a negative snap or positive.
No, it was, she was freaking stoked about it.
Yeah.
So she was like, this changes the entire dynamic of the back half of this song.
I'm like, wow, I didn't know you knew what a five lit was. Glad you liked it.
but she was super into the idea. And then I found out later she was in the actual like tracking session for the single. Jerry Rose playing drums, and she pulls out her phone of a live video of us playing it live. And she says, I want you to do this.
Hey, Jerry, play this.
It's my boy, Alec. Film.
Bro.
Yeah.
When she told me that story, I was like, oh my God, did you say my name? Please tell me you didn't say my name.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh man, I really hope that Jerry doesn't like take offense to this. Like I obviously it wasn't me in the room. So like, it wasn't me being like a head ass or anything.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It was just like, oh man, like, and obviously his fill is inspired by mine, but like way, way, way tastier.
Yeah.
But yeah, I ended up getting a credit just for that fill.
That's so cool.
It's the most absurd thing.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, I didn't either.
The fill credits. Oh my gosh.
No, but her manager texted me and was like, hey, just so you know, I credited you on this. And I was like, why? She was like, because it changed the dynamic of the song and Danielle was really adamant about giving you credit. And I was like, okay. So literally on the liner notes, it says drums by Jerry Rowe, Alec Parrish.
Bro, that means you literally made her think about the song differently by playing a fill.
Which is insane.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it wasn't anything spectacular. It was just, again, the attitude of like, what can I bring to the table that serves this song? What can I do that makes this repetitive pop demo sound different on the last chorus, you know? And it changed the whole song for her.
What a story.
It was nuts, dude.
That's so cool. And again, you can download an exact PDF transcription of the fill that Alec is talking about. Head on over to patreon.com/Nashville Drummers Podcast and sign up for just $5 a month. We've partnered with Tim Buell. He's actually transcribed a few fills from this track, Runaways by Daniel Bradbury. There's a fill at about 2:18 on the recording by Jerry Rowe. And then the original fill that Alec is discussing here, you'll be able to watch a video of Alec's live original performance. And you can see the difference of what was recorded by Jerry. It's not the same fill. It's very similar. And you can kind of see how this process evolved. And Alec discusses that as well. So again, if you want this bonus content, head on over to our Patreon. And if you dig this kind of behind the scenes content, we have a lot more coming from our guests that we're super stoked about. We appreciate your support and please let us know what you think. Back to the episode.
And then, you know, over the years, like I've gotten to go some incredible places with Danielle. I went to Australia last year. I told you guys that. And then we've done shows all across the US, played tiny, tiny towns and their farms and festivals and stuff like that. And then we've done things in New York City and all across the country. It's been a fun ride to work with her.
Yeah.
And this year she's really focused on like releasing new music. She's kind of taken a new creative direction to where she's going to be putting out like country music, but also like kind of pop heavy stuff. So she's going to like alternate her releases to where it's like one is pretty tasty country and one's pretty tasty pop.
She's like doing more of a Beyonce thing and then Beyonce's doing more country.
Yeah.
Reverse.
But she's kind of focusing on releasing music like that. So she's prioritizing recording and releasing instead of touring.
Gotcha.
So it worked out that Alana's team reached out to me and was like, hey, we'd really love to get you out as our drummer and music director and all things tracks related and stuff like that. So it's been great. I met Alana's team last year. Danielle and I were doing like an acoustic show in Philly and Alana was on the Luke Bryan like farm tour for the summer. And we were playing the like pavilion stage outside and we got rained out. And Jess Grommet on Alana's team at the time, he and Daniel Cooper, who is still on Alana's team, came over to see our show, but like had to wade through the puddles of water to get there. And so they came up to us and they were like, hey, you guys can just come hang in our green room. Like, we didn't have anywhere to sit. Like, we were sitting in a tent outside with, you know, those like plastic pallets, you know, it's like a wood pallet, but it's plastic instead. Yeah, yeah. We had like a deck of those that we had our chairs on, but like all of our gear was just rainwater was just pushing past it. And so we tried to get it all up on the stuff and then they were like, no, let's just get this inside. Yeah. So while they were figuring out what they were going to do for the show acoustic wise, they just put us inside and, you know, didn't give us any credentials, just said, stay in this room. And so Alana's team was like, hey, y'all come sit in here with us and just chill. So that's when I met Alana and her manager. And we just kind of like said, hey, and then Alana's team was actually at the festival that Danielle and I were playing at in Australia in November. It was called Riding Hearts. And it was great to reconnect with them there and just kind of like say, hey, I talked to our tour manager while I was there, who is, she also works at Good for Show, and we've worked together on other gigs. And she was just like, hey, you know, we have a couple weeks left of this headline tour and we're having some issues right now. We might need to call you to like get this sorted out. And I was like, okay, cool. Like after Thanksgiving, I have literally nothing on my calendar for the rest of the year. So call me.
So were they referring to sort it out in terms of like the show build or tracks or specifically like the drumming part?
There was someone else that was on the gig and it wasn't his first gig, but he didn't have a lot of experience and it just wasn't a good fit. You know, it was a situation where the team needed someone that was a little bit more experienced in the playback world because Alana doesn't tour with a bass player at the moment. So if tracks go down, the show really, really suffers.
Yeah.
So they need somebody that can kind of punch it back in where it needs to be, has, you know, enough wherewithal to keep the band together while also getting the show back on the rails.
Sure.
And the other guy just, it just wasn't working out. They had a couple issues on the first couple shows and he couldn't seem to like recover from the tailspin. And they loved the way that he played, but the track stuff is such an important thing for that gig that they were like, we need to get this sorted out. So, they called me and I stepped up and took over just playing drums at that point. And, we went out and played 2 weeks worth of shows in a van on a tour that was routed for a bus. So like the routing was pretty brutal. We went like New York to Stamford, Connecticut. And then after that, it was like doubling the distance every day.
Yeah.
So we went down to Philly and then we went up to Boston and then we went down to DC and then we went to Pittsburgh.
All over.
Yeah. It was just back and forth up 95, man. It was brutal.
Yeah.
But we had like the best hang in the van. I was buddies with Daniel Cooper, who plays keys and guitar. And then we had another guy named Eddie Castanera out playing guitar, and he is a riot. He's the best dude. I love him so much. And then my buddy Kyle Merkel was our production manager and audio guy. And so like just the team vibe was awesome. You know, the only way to do a van tour is to have a good team. You've got to have good people around you that like know when it's good and know when it's bad, and everyone can kind of like balance each other out. So that was a really fun way to end the year last year.
This episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast was recorded at Garden Groove Studios.
Tucked away in a private and soundproof studio in East Nashville, Garden Groove was born out of a desire to create a space where musicians, entertainers, teachers, and learners could come together. Garden Groove offers a quiet and relaxed environment for creativity to thrive and grow.
Their mission is seeded to fostering creativity and collaboration among musicians of all levels. In addition to a state-of-the-art recording space, they also offer a range of events and workshops to inspire and connect the community.
Recording, mixing, and mastering services start at just $45 an hour, and professional audio engineering services available for an additional $25 an hour. And exclusive discounts for newsletter subscribers, 25% off your first session when you subscribe.
Visit garden-groove.com to learn more and book a session. That's garden-groove.com.
But yeah, I jumped on the team with Alana then and then wasn't really expecting them to reach out for anything else unless they needed like tracks and stuff. But her MD at the time did all of her playback stuff, but he tours with another artist, and they reached out to me earlier this year and they said, hey, we really need somebody to tour with us that knows playback stuff and wants to be more like available and is more available for like track world and can make punched in edits and stuff like that. So, we just kind of connected about that and talked about what it would look like to have me on board and what their year looks like. And things have kind of shaped up to be really full this year. We're supposed to be out with Luke Bryan again this year.
Sweet.
Which is gonna be rad. Yeah. It's like 12 or 13 shows with him and festivals before, during, and after. And then there's another tour that they're about to finish confirming, I think, for the fall. That's like another 20 shows. So like, it's going to end up being a really busy year, and it's like perfectly timed out to where I don't have to really say no to a lot of like Danielle's work or anything like that. So it ended up being great.
Man, that's such a cool story. One of my favorite quotes is opportunity is when luck meets preparedness or something like that.
Expertise meets opportunity.
Yeah. And preparedness, and I feel like that's a good sort of summary for you. Like you did your homework and you were sort of ready for any of those moments. Yeah. And like all of those sort of circumstantial things where like you just got invited to, you know, it was rainy and then you, all of a sudden you met Alana and then you had good rapport and then you knew the track stuff and then you get called. Like, and that's just how this industry is, right? Like it's very rarely like, we need a drummer. Here's the audition on this date. I mean, that does happen still.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is just who you know and like what you've done in the past and how they know you from those experiences.
Yeah, man. Right. I think a handful of my gigs, like only a handful have come from like an actual audition. And I think actually now that I'm thinking about it, maybe one of my like major touring gigs came from an audition. And that was it. And the funny thing too is like, I didn't get it when they called, like they called me and said, hey, you know, the guy that we were going to replace is actually available. So we're going to let him come back out. And then 3 days later, I get a phone call and they're like, dude, he's actually having a baby and he's not available to come out. Can you be in Pittsburgh on Friday? And it was like Wednesday. It's like, yeah. And then they're like, cool. Do you have a passport? Cause we're playing Boots and Hearts on Saturday, which is in Canada.
Insane. Yeah.
And I was like, I do have a passport. Yeah. And they're like, okay, great. We'll see you on
anything
Friday.
Else. Yeah.
But yeah, every other gig that I've gotten, which, and it's like major touring stuff, full fledged major label people. A lot of it has been word of mouth. And that's not to say that auditions aren't important. It's just, again, like, saying yes to the things that get you in the room with the right people. Mm-hmm. That's more important. Like being a good hang with people is the ultimate audition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what you were doing when you first moved here, you know, going to Pinewood, not just looking for gigs, but just, and we've heard that literally every guest is like saying the same thing.
It's yeah,
like,
man.
Yeah. Just be genuine, have those real relationships with the right people.
Yeah.
And, I'm, you know, by the way, writing that down. That's a fantastic quote. Being a good hang is the ultimate audition. And I agree.
Dude, I think like getting a group of people in a room to audition, you know, two or three songs for an artist, it's a good way to like determine if people are capable. But I think the best way to audition people is to get them out on the road with you. And it's like, yes, there's a lot more at stake when you do that.
Yeah.
But if you're touring enough where you have to live with people, like on a bus or in a van or whatever it is,
yeah,
you're not going to see the full picture of people from 10 minutes in an audition room.
No.
And it doesn't matter if you go out to drinks with them afterwards or if you get coffee with them beforehand. Like the way that you learn about people is by living with them and working with them multiple times and not just once, because sometimes people have a really good show and then they can't do it ever again. Or sometimes people have a really bad show, but they're normally such a great player. Like I know a ton of people that really struggle in the audition room, but they're insane players and the best hangs. And they just don't get an opportunity to prove that.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a disservice to who they are as players and people. And, you know, it's really, this industry is so relationship based. Like I was saying, like it really requires on referrals, and that's one of the things that I love about Nashville, because, you know, other cities are super audition forward. And the only way that you can get in the door there is by having relationships with people. Yep. But here, a lot of times it's like people's word is the audition. And then you just have to like make sure that that's right. You know, you just have to confirm that those people aren't just like, hey, this is my friend.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Because there's a fair amount of that.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah. He's dope.
Dude, I was that kid.
I love him.
I was that kid. I moved up here when I was like 21, 22. And people had to like take a risk to be like, oh yeah, this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He seems like he has a good resume. I've seen a couple videos of him playing on Instagram, but like, is that real?
Right. Yeah.
Does he know how to tour? Does he know how to hang? Can he like hold a conversation with people, or is he just a player?
Yeah. Well, and it becomes hard when it becomes your friend who maybe even asks you for a recommendation that they know you can give, and sometimes you have to go, I love you and I want you to succeed. But if I recommend you to this gig right now, that might hurt me.
It's a hard pill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, a real thing. Yeah.
I'm like, ooh, that's a coffee conversation. Yeah. I love you. You're not ready for that gig. Yeah, you have to work on this. Yeah. Hey, man, fuck you. Okay, but I'm doing this because I love you and I want you to succeed. And I don't want to screw myself over.
It's like a tricky balance.
Yeah, it's like a breakup conversation with your friend. And like, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I've had to have those before. I've had to.
It's an intervention.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey. You got to work on your pocket, dude. It's not good, dude. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, man.
Everyone around you knows it. We're all suffering.
But I think your true friends will, in a respectful way, tell you that, you know,
for sure.
Because what would be worse if they do recommend you, then knowing that they're not fit for it, and that's also going to look bad on them too.
Yeah, so. It'd be like me not telling you, Dan, there is a booger hanging out of your right nostril right now. I'm not kidding. Yeah, right here in this podcast room, it's hanging out of your nose. It would be like if I didn't tell you that and that was happening, which it's not.
Hey man, at least it's on the right, not the left.
Yeah, true. It's
you got me there for a sec.
Hey drummers, are you worried about losing your hearing? Did you know noise exposure can cause permanent hearing loss?
Dr. Jason Baker with Music City Audiology provides mobile concierge services to musicians in Nashville and surrounding areas. That's right. He is 100% mobile and will come to you. If you need ear impressions, custom in-ear products, ear cleaning, hearing tests, or information about protecting your ears, he's your guy. Music City Audiology cares about drummers and wants to help you maintain your most valuable tools, your ears. Visit musiccityaudiology.com to book your consult today. That's musiccityaudiology.com.
I want to dive a little bit deeper into
Taylor to laugh. Yeah, that's my win. Yeah,
exactly. Just kind of speaking generally, I like this conversation about the industry. You've definitely, you know, made a name and become known and hireable for the tracks component. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, where do you see, because I think sometimes people, you know, are very mixed about the tracks and the live show, and especially genre specific. I feel like every major country gig is going to have tracks in some way. And it's definitely more apparent in pop music. But yeah, just what are your thoughts on the use of tracks and that balance of using and electronics? Because I know you do a lot of that with the live sets as well.
Yeah. Man, it's tricky because everybody makes records that have 90 tracks on them. You know what I mean? There's like 15 guitar tracks bounced, you know? There's lots of percussion stuff that's going on. There's synths, there's, you know, auxiliary things like steel and dobro, and like, it's impossible to get all of that covered on a live stage, especially when you're touring on a budget like a baby artist. So I think until you can actually cover all of the information on stage with people, you need tracks. Like, you just need to. And like, you can hire great musicians that can play, you know, in great time that don't need a click, and you can make it work without tracks. But the step up that you kind of see and feel, especially from the audience perspective, when there are sounds that are from the record, it really makes a big difference to just the average listener that's there. You know, I see a lot of comments on like videos of people that are playing, and like, you know, I had coffee with my buddy Jeremy Schaefer yesterday, who's awesome drummer. He's out with Daughtry. But I remember last year he posted a video of his ears dying in the middle of the set. And so he had a tech that was there that was like tapping him on his back to keep him in time with the tracks. And he had to turn the comments off on that video because people were just flogging him.
I think I've seen that video.
Dude, it's insane. And it's like, it's just a cool moment. Like, we were talking earlier about those moments of like everyone stayed together and like, holy shit, we did it. Like, that is the ultimate holy shit moment. Like, his whole mix disappeared.
And
he just like had to stay in time to get through the end of the song. So like, I see people in those comments that are saying, you know, real musicians don't need tracks, like real bands don't need tracks, stuff like that. And it's just like, sure, dude, like the classic OK Boomer line, like I get it. Like there are plenty of artists here in Nashville that don't use tracks, and that's awesome. I love that. But they prioritize what they want to sound like. They hire people to give them the sound that they want. That is their top priority from the record.
Right.
It's not always the same. You know, some people have, you know, an aux player that's playing keys, banjo, guitar, whatever the song calls for. Other people have a dedicated pedal steel player, you know, and that's all they can really cover. That's cool. That's awesome. Does that work for everybody? Absolutely not. With Alana's team right now, we're touring with three players and there's a ton of tracks.
Yeah.
But my job is to balance what is being played on stage and what is being played from tracks.
Right.
So I sit there and I just kind of redesigned a lot of the tracks and printed a lot of things indifferently, like, you know, re-leveled everything, made sure everything was balanced, and then committed it all down to like essentially new stems. So like all the guitar parts are now balanced in one stereo stem. And then all of the percussion stuff is in one stereo stem, and then effects and stuff like that.
So when you're analyzing these stems for the set, are you trying to be as close to the record as possible? Are you given direction to actually change it a little bit for the live show?
Most of the time I'm trying to stay close to the record unless things are arrangement like specific.
Yep.
So there's a couple moments in Alana's set where they've kind of created talking points or anything like that. And so there's percussion loops that are not on the record that have been produced by either the record producer or previous MDs or something like that. And part of my job is to just make sure that those like gel with the rest of the tracks, or, you know, listening to a rehearsal board tape and seeing if anything's like poking out while she's like having her talking point. You know what I mean? Like listening and seeing like, okay, that snare sound probably should be a little bit more compressed there. And like, not sticking through the mix to like really catch someone's attention. Like you just want to feel it and not hear it at that moment. So I spend a ton of time thinking critically, like as a listener. That way, when we get to rehearsal, we're making global changes and not like individual things that have to be pulled out. Like one snare sample has to be dropped 6 dB. Right. It's like, okay, cool. The whole percussion track is right where it needs to be. The keys are like 3 dB too hot. Let's pull those down. Mm-hmm. And that's a note that I get from an audio engineer. They're like, okay, cool, man. Your tracks sound good. Like I think overall we can bring the keys stem or the guitar stem down 3 dB for the whole set, or for just this one song or something like that.
Yeah.
So making sure that tracks are normalized is probably the most time consuming part of what I do in track world. But again, like it's very specific on what gig we're talking about, because if I'm producing things and like having to program parts and do stuff like that, that's super time consuming.
Yeah.
But most of the time I have the information at my fingertips to just kind of drag it from somewhere else and kind of warp it, tweak it, make it crushed and sound different to where I can just place it instead of having to like reinvent the wheel. And then obviously like when you start getting into heavy touring gigs, like having to recreate the stems and stuff like that, so they don't have to pay the master licenses for the players that did that. That's another side of track world that I've gotten into recently. Like my buddy Justin Eason and I, we work together a ton. He's such a great MD. And he was Danielle's MD for years. But he is incredible about pulling stems from the record and listening to them and saying, okay, cool, how can we make this sound different but still have the same structure and unique design for what we're going for? And it just makes everything more cost efficient for the artist, which means they can ultimately play more shows and pay the team better or have better accommodations on a bus or whatever it ends up being. It all comes out better for like the touring people.
Yeah. It seems to be the trend today is like touring is more expensive. You can't have a 6-piece band and it has to sound like the record, you know?
Yeah.
Do you find yourself listening?
Before we move on, I think it's important to say that I want my live shows to sound as close to the record as possible without it being boring, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of fans connect with music with how they hear it. You know, they hear it on the radio or Sirius FM or whatever their listening mode is. They hear a song and they, you know, hear a part and they're like, okay, this is the lyric, or this is the, you know, vocal melody. It's cool to change things, but people get lost when you change too much.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So changing arrangement structures is fun, and it's really cool to do like interesting hits and parts and all kinds of stuff like that. But I think the more, again, honoring the song, like the song was recorded the way that it was and
for a reason.
Yeah. And it feels really good most of the time. So like, how can we recreate that magic live? How can we make it feel like the studio recording, but like a little amped up, a little live, and then like throw in some tasty bits here and there to make people really pay attention so that they're like vibing with the song. Cause there's, man, there's nothing better. Like I went to see Lainey at Municipal a couple weeks ago and I've seen them play like four or five times now. Every time there's always some little ear candy bit that I'm just like, what the fuck was that? You know,
yeah, like that wasn't on the record. That
was something different. And like Jake's got like this crazy pitched up side snare that he hits on like random occasions. And every single time I just like snap my head and I'm like, what the fuck was that? I was there with Jess Grommet. He and I and our wives we were sitting together and we were just vibing the whole time. And like every moment we would just like grab each other's arm and be like, what was that?
Well, see, that's the good point. Because then if you go the other way, if it's too close to the record, then why are people paying to come out
exactly
to the live show? We talk about that a bunch.
Yeah.
There has to, there's a balance.
Yeah.
You've heard of Drum Supply, but you gotta see their shop. It's a drum shop experience like no other. They're packed with all the gear a working drummer needs, and so many parts, noise toys, and accessories. It's a toy store. Curated cymbals, kits, and snares. The hands-on percussion room is nuts, and their custom shop work is fast and affordable. Andy and the guys know their stuff, and they're ready to help. And the big news? They've just moved to an awesome new location near the corner of East Trinity Lane and Dickerson Pike. Still in East Nashville, just a couple miles from their old spot, the all-new Drum Supply is twice as big, featuring a dedicated cymbal room, a lesson space, and even more drum gear than ever. Go see the new Drum Supply shop for yourself. Now open 11 to 5 at 2211 Dickerson Pike and online at drumsupply.com.
We've been renting from the same house for like 3 years and we love it and we love our neighbors. So we're really sad to leave, but like we're pumped.
Yeah, it's time.
We're really pumped to be homeowners and like really start establishing our own space, having a place to make records and like produce other people.
Next journey.
Yeah, man. And my wife she's such a talented singer. She went to Syracuse for musical theater.
Oh, cool.
Does not work in music.
Fellow New Yorker then.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. You know, her family's from the like upstate area, Elmira, kind of vibe.
Yeah, familiar.
She went to school at Syracuse and studied musical theater. She was like a child actor. She was stage acting productions. She was in the American Girl show in Chicago.
Oh, cool.
When she was like in middle school and high school.
Yeah.
But like, she doesn't work in music. And she just kind of like recently was like, I want to start like making music again.
Dude.
And I was like, cool, we have a studio coming. Like I've done some voiceover stuff with her before. And now it's like, hey, you want to sing on something? Like this Ableton session I'm building needs some BGV tracks. Mm-hmm. You want to do something saucy?
Hashtag power couple. Let's go.
Dude.
I'm really excited for you. Man, that's going to be really cool.
Fellow married person with a wife who's musical, who doesn't do music.
Yeah.
Same.
Best.
That's a very specific similarity.
Best.
Yeah. Yeah. It took a second to say it. Yeah. It was a lot.
I was tracking the whole time. And you know who else is like that? Jess Grommet.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
This is like the fifth mention of Jess.
I know. Yeah.
I love you, Jess.
You're the best.
Where are you? There you are.
There he is.
Jess, I love you.
We've reversed Nate's camera now.
No, Jess is one of my best friends. Yeah, y'all should get coffee. Jess is one of my best friends, and I actually introduced him to his wife. And
look at you.
Damn, you got Phil credit and wife credit. Look at that.
That's
is that a thing?
It took me a second. For a second, I was like, "Who's Phil?"
Yeah.
If he didn't thank you on the wedding card, on the invitation, then I think GTFO.
Was there an entree named after you?
I think they said something about it in their ceremony. And like Carly, his wife, like turned and like looked at me and just kind of smiled. Cause like I was friends with both of them individually. And we all ended up going to see Julia Michaels together at Marathon a couple years ago. It was right before COVID. And I had an extra ticket to go to that show. And so I just like texted Jess day of and was like, "Hey dude, I don't know what you're doing tonight. You want to go see Julia?" And he was like, "I would freaking love to." I was like, "Great, let's go." At the time, my normal haunt was this bar called The Mainstay, which used to be like right on the corner of East Nashville, like Main Street and 5th, 10th. That's where it is.
It must have been before my time here.
It might have been.
I got here in 2020. I don't remember that place.
Yeah, it was really cool. It's a different restaurant now, but it was a good restaurant and bar. And yeah, the bar manager at the time that I was regularly going there.
Yeah.
Bar manager there used to be the bar manager at Rose Pepper. So they had the original Rose Pepper margarita recipe.
Oh.
And it was dangerous.
I've heard that.
Yeah. It was dangerous. So a couple of friends of mine and I would always go up there, happy hour. It was like 2-for-1 margs. Just, yeah. It was a good way to introduce myself to Nashville, I'll tell you what.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we ended up, Jess, Carly, and I ended up meeting at the Mainstay before the show to just have a couple of margaritas and then go and see Julia. And they really hit it off. And that was that.
There you go. The rest is history.
Connecting people left and right, man.
I love it.
Look at you.
I love it.
All right. So margaritas, we met over coffee.
Yeah, we did. Coffee is my other love.
What are your other go-to spots in Nashville?
Oh, man. Well, I'm wearing an Elegy.
Yes.
Elegy pin.
That's my favorite. Oh, nice. I didn't know they sold those. Yeah, man. They have some cool merch.
Got that. It was a Christmas gift one year. It was like a little Elegy pack. It was nice. Awesome. I do love their cold brew. It is one of my favorites in town.
I think that's the second time that I've heard that exact thing.
Elegy cold brew.
Elegy cold brew.
It's next level.
Have you had their bagels?
I haven't.
So, I think I forget where they get them from. It's not. It's like they've sourced it from another brand here.
I've been making my own coffee like an asshole. What's wrong with me?
Economical.
I need to go to places where coffee is great and made for me.
Oh man,
Garden Groove.
Yeah. There it is.
That's why I come here.
man, I love. I'm very partial to a lot of East Nashville spots, obviously, because I've just been in this neighborhood for so long. But I love Living Waters. That's one of my go-tos.
That's a great spot, man.
That's just like next level, like new wave coffee. I sound like such a prick saying that, like new wave coffee.
No, but if you haven't been there, you might feel like that. But if you've been there, you're like, oh yeah, it is.
It's great.
It really is.
It can feel almost pretentious there, but not in a barista parlor way.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which, exactly.
Don't get me wrong. Barista parlor coffee slaps.
Oh yeah.
But sometimes you just get a little judgment from the baristas there. And I don't know if that's a interview question that they ask when they hire people.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, do you judge people if they ask for a pour over in a to-go cup? Well, usually we don't like to give it in the to-go cup because it messes with the flavor profile. Hey, dude, do you make coffee or do you not make coffee? I'm so confused right now.
Yeah, I'm paying you for a service.
Yeah, the folks at Living Water are the sweetest people.
They really gave
me attitude one time. I was trying to order an iced espresso drink for somebody that was in the rehearsal room at Claire.
Yeah.
And they were like, we don't do espresso over ice. It ruins the shot. And I was like, okay, give me a cup of ice then.
Okay.
And I'll do it. And I literally did it in front of them. I was like, I'm sorry. Like, this is what my friend ordered. Like,
I'm going to do it in front of you so hard make eye contact.
It's at the bar top right there. This is the only table that was open. So I was just like, all right.
Here's the thing that I literally want. You're saying it ruins it. I desire it.
Yeah.
So who's wrong?
Customers, you're wrong. I literally said to the guy, I was like, the person that ordered this drink orders this exact same drink from Starbucks. I don't think it's going to bother them. And they're like, we won't do it. And I was like, all right, man. That's the hill.
Yeah, but see, they would probably look down cool. on
That's on the one. Starbucks. I was wondering which one you die
corporate
on.
Coffee.
That's the one.
This is going to be so fun to do in front of you.
No, it's funny that we're talking so much about coffee because it is such a big part of my life. Yeah. I have an entire like Pelican for coffee
really?
Stuff. Yeah.
Very cool.
It's like, it goes with me everywhere. My wife gave me so much shit about it when I first bought it, but I have like an actual Pelican that has like a Baratza Encore grinder that lives in it and a Chemex pour over. And it's like, it's legit. I'll tell you what, man, when the second show that I was out with Alana, we were in Chicago. I ripped that thing out and she's a big coffee girl.
So there you go.
Big coffee girl.
So you wouldn't find that in an audition, right?
No,
exactly. Moments, connections.
So I whipped that thing out and just started making a batch and was just like, you know, 3 or 4 cups worth. And I just started pouring and was like, I don't know if anybody wants this, but it'll get drunk. And Alana was like, give me 2. So she was super pumped.
Nice.
And I think that was the moment that she was like, oh yeah, I think I like really want to work with this guy because he understands this addiction.
Hey drummers, do you need a place in Nashville to practice on actual drums? Drumbox is Nashville's newest drum practice studio. Book sessions online and get the space to yourself. It's fully equipped with 2 kits, cymbals, hardware, and even sticks are provided. 30-minute, 1-hour, and 2-hour sessions are available at www.drumbox.space and use the coupon code NDP25 for 25% off your first session. Again, that's www.drumbox.space. What got you started and what was the first thing that you were like, this is why I gotta play and this is why I want to play all the time?
Man, when I was younger, I listened to a lot of music, but no one in my family really was musical. Like my parents didn't do anything in music. My mom was, she was a majorette when she was in high school. So she was on like the color guard and did that. Okay, and she was a baton twirler. So she was rhythmic, I'll say.
Music adjacent.
Yes, music adjacent. Very important for, you know, marching band stuff. But she really musical, like loves music. And my dad, he, you know, my parents grew up in the era of like going to see like the biggest rock bands of all time was like $5. You know, my dad saw the Rolling Stones at the Fox Theater in Atlanta for $5.
Wow.
And it was because at the time they were touring under, I think the name was the Cockroaches. They were doing like this was pre-social media, obviously.
Right.
But like they could do that thing there. Right. There wasn't like press outlets that were exposing them fast enough to where the cities that they were playing in, the crowds knew what was going on. But there was just like one day, there was just a bill put up on the wall of the Fox Theater that was like, the Cockroaches, one night only. And everyone was like, who the fuck is the Cockroaches? And my dad was like, I think I know what's going on here.
Yeah.
And so he got in line and got tickets and he saw the Stones. And this was like the height of the Stones. Like it was, he said it was one of the best shows he's ever seen.
Wow.
But he was a, you know, not an audiophile, but he was just a music fiend growing up. Listened to records all the time. And then when I was growing up, I was just taking in that music, you know, that era. Like I remember regularly listening to like AC/DC and Aerosmith with my dad. Neither of my parents played anything though. They didn't play guitar or anything like that. I have 2 older brothers, both of whom actually did learn how to play guitar when they were growing up, but they never did anything serious with it. You know, like my middle brother and I started playing music together, at a church. You know, like a lot of my story comes from like starting in the church world. Mm-hmm. So when I was in middle school, I had to start taking electives at the school, you know? And so like, it was either band or chorus. I didn't really want to sing. So I did band and I was like, I'll do percussion. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
had no idea what it was, but I was like, yeah, I just want to do percussion. Like, any of this sounds cool. Like, I'll play the triangle. That's fun. So I did band for 2 or 3 years in middle school and started marching and really loved it. Like, I remember really falling in love with marching, and I was in pit for 1 year, and then I was on bottom bass for the second year. An eighth grader holding up a big 26-inch bass
drum. That's the toughest one, I think.
Dude, yeah. it was that. And then I was going to play quads the next year, but I changed schools.
Yeah.
And the school that I went to didn't have a marching program. So I like missed out on the chops,
yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I started playing in marching band and doing other like concert and symphonic bands and stuff like that through school. And then I was like really involved at my church in middle school and high school. They had like a big youth center that they had like developed for like the youth group. And part of my childhood was like, again, earlier I said I was a pop punk kid, but before I was a pop punk kid, I was like in the hardcore scene.
Let's go.
Through my church. We had like an outreach ministry for the local youths at the youth center. And nice. It was awesome. It's a venue, or it was a venue. I don't know if it still is. It was a venue in Loganville, Georgia called The Movement. And it was awesome. It was so cool. I learned how to stage dive. I learned how to be a security guard. I learned how to load in. It was honestly like,
that sounds like the coolest church.
Dude, thinking about it now, like as a kid, I learned how to tour without doing anything. And like, I was just always around at the church. Like after school, my brother and I would go to the church and hang out with the staff and like the people that were, you know, younger, but not like, you know, too old or anything like
that. Well, see, and I'm going to stop you there too, because you said hang out, like you probably didn't know it then, but do you think looking back on it now, like you also learned how to hang?
100%.
Right? Yeah. How to be a person.
Yeah, man. Yep. That's wow.
Boom.
Got me. Yeah, man. Like we would go and sit up there and put a Spotify play. I think Spotify was around at that point. We would just put a record on like the freaking PA of the venue. And just listen to it. And it's like Taking Back Sunday or like Paramore's first album, Misery Business album. Like we would just listen to all kinds of music and go see shows together. And like, it was just like a really tight community of like 8 of us that would just hang out there all
That's
the time.
Cool.
Yeah, it was great, man. But because I was so invested at the church, I like started volunteering on Sunday mornings to like play in like the actual Sunday services. And it was a very traditional church at the time. It was an Anglican church. So there was like a traditional, very traditional service that was just kind of like the only music that you heard was like people singing prayers and stuff like that.
Right.
And then like the chime of a bell or something like that at the end of the prayer. And then after that, there was a contemporary service that was for the younger crowd. And that was the one that like all the youth group people would go to. It was a little bit later so you could sleep in and you know, you could go and hang. So they had a live band there and like a full drum kit and like people playing guitars and basses and stuff like that. So I, being like sixth grade or seventh grade, wanted to get involved. So I had never played drums before. Like I was in band, but I'd never played a real kit. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there and like they have all these random percussion instruments, like a djembe and some congas and like wind chimes and like shakers. And I'm just like,
because of course they do.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we have contemporary music. So I'm just like playing my heart out, you know, trying to like learn how to be in a band at that point. There was no really like rehearsals or anything like that. It was just kind of like an hour before the service, we show up and get mixes and play the songs once and go. And then my buddy David, one of the guys that was like kind of on staff at the church, but like we would always hang out after school and stuff like that. He was the guy that always played drums. And so one Sunday morning, he was a no-show. And they were like, you have to play drums. And I was like, I have never done this before in my entire life. I'm not doing this. And they were like, you are the closest thing to a drummer we have. So like, you got to make it work. And I was like, all right. So I did. And it was probably sloppy and I don't remember most of it, but I remember at the end of it, they were like, okay, that was great. Like, let's get you back up here sometime. And I was like hungry to do it after they said that.
Yeah. Let's like, get me back up.
Let's do that again. That was cool.
This feels good. Yeah.
But like, I didn't have a kid at home. I couldn't really play the one at school because it was for like the high schooler. I was at a private school in middle school at the time. And the high schooler that played it was like part of the basketball band. And it was like his personal kit. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the school kit. So, yeah, I just was like, okay, cool. I got to find out how to like practice. And so then it became after school hangs at the church in the youth room. I was playing on that kit. And I just, that's when I really started digging into music and listening to like, man, I don't know if you guys know that band Emery.
Oh yeah.
Kind of like heavier Christian band at the time. The Almost with Aaron Gillespie and like Under Oath, obviously, was just like doing everything I could to learn how to play drums like that.
Yeah.
And just like raw power, not necessarily like blast beats. Cause like definitely can't do that.
No, but Aaron smashes the
drums. Dude, he absolutely destroys drums. When Neil was here, was it before or after Aaron was on the weekend with them?
I don't remember.
It was probably before then.
Because we didn't talk about that.
Dude. Yeah. So those boys in Nate's band are good friends of mine. And Neil said that when Nate had Aaron Gillespie out to do like a writing retreat on the road, and they were just like working on songs on the bus during the day. And then on like night two, Aaron was like, let me in. And he just like came out and played half of Whiskey on You or something like that. And then the next night he did the whole thing. And at the end of it, I think Neil had a completely cracked set of cymbals absolutely pitted heads. And I'm pretty sure that Aaron was just like, here's my card, go to Guitar Center.
What a story.
But yeah, I mean, that was the kind of like attitude that I wanted to like learn how to play drums to. And so I was like playing on Wednesdays at like youth group ministry stuff and was really cutting my teeth doing that. And then, you know, on Sunday mornings, I couldn't play like that because we're in like almost like a cathedral style room. Yeah. And so it taught me how to like kind of
discipline.
Yeah. Like rein it in and like play to the room instead of like just beating the shit out of the drums. And then I'd go home and like listen to music and like try and figure out how, like, I think at that time I didn't know how to write music. Like I didn't know how to notate it. Like I could play from band stuff. Like I could read music, but I didn't know charts. Obviously at that point there was no charts in my life. There wasn't really like drum tabs, which is how a lot of my friends were learning how to play guitar. And I was just trying to figure out how to learn songs. And so I had this like audible memory that I started developing of like, this verse goes like this, and then the chorus goes like this. And then that has now become how I chart music. I do most of it as like a listen through, and then I'll like make a chart of like kick patterns. And then it's just that.
Yep.
Like I'm just looking at where the kick note falls in relation to where we are in the song. And then the rest of it is just muscle memory.
Yeah, man. We had Vincent Williams on. Remember that conversation?
Oh yeah.
He talked a lot about learning songs and he was kind of knocking on people that just like try to learn it too quickly. Mm-hmm. And his thing was just like, yeah, listen for like, just listen for like five takes and like just hear things first.
Yeah. I mean, you learn so much about the song and like playing the song, you want it to feel right.
Right.
So if you're just listening to what the chord progression is, or if you're just listening to the kick pattern, or, you know, trying to find where to fit in some ghost notes or tasty licks, like you're not doing the song justice. You're just trying to be done as fast as possible and find a place for you to shine.
Yeah. You're just waiting for the space to say what you want to say.
Yes.
Rather than listening to what the other guys are trying to say.
It's just, it's a conversation with music, dude. You're just waiting to talk over it instead of listening to what it has to say and reply to it. So I learned a lot about that when I didn't have a drum kit at my house. And then I was a sophomore in high school when my parents, or maybe I was a freshman. I think I was a sophomore. When my parents got me my first drum kit.
Which was?
It was a Pearl.
Which Pearl? Export?
It was an Export, yeah.
Finish?
The red one.
There you go.
Metallic Red.
Dang, dude.
Metallic I was waiting red. For that. Yep. Yeah. We ask every guest, or it comes up pretty much in every conversation.
And most of the time, kit. It's probably that one. It's,
except last time it was a Yamaha.
Dang it.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I played the hell out of that kit. I set it up in my closet to make it as dead as possible. And my brother, you know, keeping along with thread of like us being into like heavier music at the time, my brother had like a PV 5150 half stack just cause. And I would wheel that cab into my closet, put in earplugs and plug my iPod into it and just fucking rip.
Yeah,
just buddy. Rip it. And I'm pretty sure my parents have more patience than I could ever dream for by letting me do that, because it was, I mean, it was cooking in there at like 110 dB probably.
Yeah, I bet.
It was so loud.
God bless parents that let their kids
just
play
wail.
The drums.
Just wail,
seriously.
Dude. Yeah. I
feel the same way. I'm like, how could they possibly put up with that?
Yeah. It's frustrating for me, and I, you know, do it for a living sometimes, you know? But yeah, it was a really cool moment to like be able to start working on stuff at home at that point. And then, you know, in high school, I went to a Christian school that had like a, you know, weekly chapel service. And one of the electives I could take in high school instead of taking orchestra band was worship band. And so like every day or every 2 days, we'd meet in one of the classrooms that the band stuff was in. And I would like practice on like V drums and we would get a service put together for the next week chapel. And I started doing that a lot. So continuing that theme of like church music and like playing with other people, working on being in a band and not just playing by myself. And then I ended up, you know, really connecting with the teacher in that classroom. He was like a worship leader at Athens Church at the time. And so I kept asking him over and over again, 'cause I knew that their music program was like so cool. And I have this recurring like desire to put myself, I have horrible imposter syndrome. Like just absolutely debilitating.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it's like the only thing that makes sense to my brain is to put myself in a room with people that are way better than me. It challenges me. It makes me work really hard. And it keeps me like focused on developing my craft instead of just being, you know,
complacent
yeah. and happy with mediocrity. That's not to say that, you know, I haven't done anything good or anything cool, but like forcing myself to be in an uncomfortable situation makes me adapt. And that makes me a stronger player. It makes me a better hang.
Love that. Yeah.
It's so important for me. And that was my desire in high school. But like thinking back to it now, I wasn't aware of what I was doing, but like I was challenging myself and I wanted to like rise to the occasion and be like this young dude that could keep up, not for my ego or anything like that, just for the love of the game. And like, eventually I wore the guy down. His name was Britt Jones. I wore him down and I just like, I got a page over the intercom one day that was like Alec Parrish to Britt Jones' office. And so I went to his classroom and he was like, hey, it was like a Thursday. He was like, hey, we can't find someone to play drums for Sunday. Are you free? And I was like, yeah, man. He was like, awesome.
Put me in.
They put me in. I think I was a senior and it was like the first 2 weeks of school or something like that. He put me in. I'd been in his class for like 3 years at that point. So he knew that I could like kind of keep up. And it was a totally different environment once I got there though. It was like 6 a.m. call time. You know, this is the wardrobe. Like you got to wear this kind of thing, show up. We're going to do rehearsal Sunday morning, sound check, bring your in-ears and like grip it and rip it.
Yeah.
And that started it all, you know, like that was my step into professional playing at that point.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
You were in middle high school?
I was in high school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about it. Like I had seen that teacher, that class teacher play at that church when I was a freshman when I was there with some friends from school. And then like the following 3 years, I was just beating him up, trying to like get on stage and just like work with him or work with anyone from the church, just because I knew that it was another level of professionalism. And it's funny, we kind of circle back to that question we asked earlier of like, are tracks necessary? Does it make a difference? Is it the only way to be pro or anything like that? That was a church that was using tracks, and the church that I'd been playing at wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I felt the difference.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to be involved there. I really wanted to listen to music there. I really wanted to play the music there. So I got super into it and fought for it over and over again. And then finally I got through and became really, really good friends with some of the people that were on the team at that church, like the production, production manager and people on the programming team. And they started inviting me to come back. And then every year for my 4 years of being at school at Georgia, I was there at least 2 times a month. And there was like one season my junior year where I was there every week for 3 months. I think they were trying to do like the same band for a quarter and then rotate and have like a couple new people come in and do that. That got me like consistent, and I was paying attention to like learning new music every week and developing like how to study music, and while also trying to be in a band and have a social life and date and do all that, you know, like it was crazy thinking back on it now. Like, I haven't really thought about this in a long time. So it's like, it's really interesting to look back at it with the perspective of where I'm at right now in my career and how similar some things are and how different a lot of things are.
I'm glad we could put the microphone in and give you that perspective.
Yeah, man.
I think you have a really cool and healthy and mature, especially at that age, like a mature mindset of, you mentioned the imposter syndrome, which I think a lot of us can relate to, especially as we get older, especially being in a town like Nashville.
Oh yeah.
And like, we talk about that a lot, about like putting yourself, making yourself uncomfortable to grow. You kind of have to, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah. I think I have a healthy relationship with it. Or at least I'm just aware of it and I try to operate around it. When I was in school at Georgia, I was studying, you know, some business stuff. I got a marketing degree and a music business degree.
Cool.
And the head of the music business program is this legendary producer who still lives in Athens, still the director of the program. His name's David Barbie. And he was the guy that I would always go to and be like, man, I want to play, but like, how do I make this happen? And he was like, you got to go where music's being made. You know, Athens is a cool place, but like, for what you want to do, is this the right place? And I, the answer was no. So I moved to Atlanta because it was the safest bet for me, because I had connections in the church world there. I'd been doing that. I could still come home. I could have still lived at home with my parents if I wanted to, because Athens is only like an hour and 10 minutes away from Atlanta.
Yeah, it was a relatively safe move for
so
you.
So like, I was still close to home. I had a community of people down there that I knew very well. And I had some friends from college that were like asking me to move in with them when I started having this conversation with people. So it was just kind of like an opportunity presented itself. I took it up, moved to Atlanta. And then again, I had that voice of David Barbie in my ear saying like, you got to go where music's being made that you want to play. And so I was like, all right, cool. Well, like my path to get to what I want to do is, my next lily pad is Nashville, because I've got people that I know there and there's some good music being made there. And like, I can definitely become a better player by being around much better people. Mm-hmm. But like, man, these people are so much better than me.
Yeah.
They are such bigger fish and it's such a bigger pond. Mm-hmm. How can I even come close to finding my lane? And a buddy of mine, this guy named Ryan Harvey, he is a producer now, but he was in Atlanta for a while. He was a drummer and an Ableton guy. I learned a lot of Ableton stuff from him. But he was touring with Thomas Rhett as his playback tech, and he was living here. And he gave me some advice. He was like, look, dude, like if you want to be competitive, like you've got to have a competitive edge. Like you've got to find your skill set that sets you apart. And like, there's a lot of people here that can do everything that I can do. But is there one thing that I offer that someone else doesn't, right, or that everyone doesn't offer. You know what I mean?
Or you offer it in a slightly different way.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. Or like, yeah. You know, to make it a finer point, like if there's 100 people in, you know, a square mile that can play drums exactly like me, right. But only 10 of them can operate Ableton like me, then that pool is a lot smaller. You know right. what I mean? The pond is smaller. There's not as many fish.
Yeah.
And that was the perspective that I started to come to Nashville with, was like, how can I implement my Ableton stuff? How can I implement working with electronics? How can I start putting triggers on things? And how can I have samples coming live instead of from playback? Like, how can I build that side of stuff to make my approach to the gig different than either of y'all or anyone else? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautifully said. I mean, I was going to ask like advice for younger drummers trying to make it or move here, but I mean, I think you gave a perfect answer.
That just covered it. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you, Ryan Harvey.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, focus on developing relationships. That's the first and foremost thing that you can do to get in the room. And then when you're not in the room, focus on developing something about yourself that sets you apart. And that can be the way that you play, any kind of stylistic choices that you have in your playing, or technology edges that you can think of, you know?
Yeah.
I have a buddy of mine that he always traveled with a Nord that he would put next to him, not as a playback controller, but he would like play keys stuff while he was touring. And it was like big in the CCM world, but like, that was his thing. Like, he was the guy that could play drums and keys at the same time.
That's
and
cool.
It's like, that's so outrageous to think about.
Yeah.
But like, he was busy, dude. He was really busy.
Yeah. You see, if you see something like that once and it's even something that could remotely benefit you as someone looking for a bandmate.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah. Yeah. Got it. Talk to that guy.
Yeah. Just don't spread yourself too thin. You know what I mean? Don't try to be a master of all. Like,
dude, that is so hard.
It's so hard because you want to have an edge. You want to be the guy. You want to be the person that people call as the Ableton guy or as whatever it ends up being. But like, if you're trying to do too many things, then you're just like, when I call people for a gig, I search like drums or I search bass or guitar in my contacts. And it's just a list of names that I've associated as their like company name is like, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And if you're the person that has like 20 things, but you can't hang with any of those things, then you're going to get called one time and you're never going to get called again.
Yep.
You know, like if you're putting yourself in every pond, but you're drowning in all of it, you're setting yourself up to fail.
I love it.
Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when I meet a talented pedal steel player here and then, you know, a month, 6 months later, they're out on these big gigs. It's like, well, yeah, it's because there's not that many of you here.
Right. Yeah, dude.
Just that alone is like you stand out because of the instrument you play.
Yeah.
But I think for drummers, it's, as you said, maybe harder because like there are 100 drummers within East Nashville probably that can play as good as us. Maybe 50 of them can also do Ableton. So it's like, how far deep can you go to really stand out, you know?
Yeah. And when I was first moving up here, Ableton was still pretty, it was being used, but like it was a show up and press play. It wasn't a how does this work conversation.
Right.
And so that was my edge, was like, I could sit down and talk about it with people. So like if something went wrong, I knew why and I could fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, we talked about Motus for a minute. Like I had so many interfaces crash on me. I had so many link sessions between the computer and the keys player who had their computer up with an Ableton session doing all of their sounds. And like something happened and it disconnected and then the keys triggered the wrong song. And it was just like a mess. Like
jeez.
I've had everything that could go wrong in Ableton go wrong. And I can tell you about how to prevent it or at least how to fix it when it happens.
Yeah. And you're better off because of that.
Exactly.
Totally.
Yeah. But especially like now being up here in the position that I'm in where it's like, or at least at the time when I first moved up here, there weren't as many people that were that experienced with Ableton.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good for me to like establish myself as a young player and, you know, get in the room with people that were much more established that wanted to maybe talk about some more experienced things, but weren't sure if I could hang with it.
Yeah.
And then that gave me an opportunity to be like, cool, we can have that conversation. Like, I don't have the tour experience that you have, but like, you want to talk about some shit blowing up on Ableton? Like, yeah, I'm right there with you, dude.
Yeah, man. I love it.
I think we've covered our bases.
I'm glad we went back, by the way.
Yeah, there's
some really good stuff there. And I think it's really special. We've talked a fair amount of guests that have a similar church background, and it's really cool hearing like that's been a really important part of your life.
Yeah, it's
still you know.
Yeah, man, it's interesting too, because like
just that community aspect. And
yeah, and like you want to talk about learning how to hang, like when you're spending a full day with people like in the green room in between services and stuff like that, like you learn how to have fun when you're exhausted. And
yes,
like that set me up for tour. I'll tell you what, like van tours, man, you don't get a lot of sleep.
Oh, yeah. Early mornings in a volunteer service.
Yeah.
Very familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like how early you have to get before the service starts. Same thing with a tour,
and
right?
It helps with so much stuff, like production wise, like, you know, having to worry about lights and, you know, creeping onto stage at certain moments and like having musical conversations with people, whether you have a talk back or not, you know, like having an active listening opportunity on stage, it gives you a lot more perspective when you're touring of like, cool, how can we make this moment feel emotional? Or how can we make this moment feel really big and in your face?
Yeah.
And it's like, not to borrow too many things from the church world, but like, there's a lot of dynamic shifts that you can do just that mimic a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of totally, in all of our DNA that at least grew up in the church.
Beautiful.
Not the same as it ever was. Sonique Drums is the fledgling but fierce drum and percussion manufacturer based out of the Pinery, Colorado. They started their first year in business swinging and continue to punch up at the percussion industry at large. Sonique Drums is designing and manufacturing new, innovative, and better-made percussion accessories like the NATO 1, an industry-first, continually adjustable throw-off, or another industry-first, the 12-point drum key. Sonique Drums also specializes in steam-bent snare drums, using domestic and exotic tone woods, equipped with all brass hardware. You can demo and buy Sonique Drums, original accessories, and snares in Nashville at Nelson Drum Shop, or meet them in person at the Music City Drum Show in July. Check them out at soniquedrums.com.
I was going to ask just a quick question.
Yeah, man.
Totally unrelated, but if you don't mind sharing your tattoo on your right arm there.
Yeah. So I have these two guys that are connected. These are both by an artist here in East Nashville named Chipper Harbin.
Cool.
This first one was my first tattoo.
Like this.
Yeah. So this guy, this is just an hourglass.
See, this whole time I thought it was because you would love playing triangle in middle school.
You know, that is I'm going to keep that in my back pocket. No, it's great, man. I got this like 5 years ago, I think. And when I was sitting in the chair with Chipper, he and I were just kind of shooting shit, talking about growing up. And he's from a town in Georgia called Toccoa. And I used to work at a summer camp really close by. And we talked about, you know, the dogs, and he and I became really good friends after that because we started watching football together. Mm. But he was working on this with me, and the inspiration behind that tattoo was like a handful of different reasons, but you know, I'm a quality time, love language kind of dude. Mm. I really enjoy like sitting down with people like this and just having conversations and getting to be like connected with folks.
Yeah.
Like I really enjoy that.
Oh, I see. Okay. So the big hourglass.
Yeah. Gotcha. Big hourglass moving down.
Nice. Yeah.
Sand falling through, time passing. I'm a keeper of time by trade, obviously.
Love it.
Yes, and there's also a very subtle nod to a Harry Potter reference, Time Turners.
Hey, come on now.
Big Harry Potter guy.
Come on now. Favorite movie?
They're
all special.
I think three. It's either three or six.
Six.
Four was my favorite book. But
yeah.
I hated what they did to the Triwizard Tournament.
Tournament.
I hated it.
Yep.
I hate what they did to a lot of things.
Yeah.
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 Books all the way, baby.
Did you put your name in like a little file?
What the heck? What is that? Hey, the most gentle, even-keel guy in the whole series, and you're going to have him screaming at the
across
main
a room.
Character? That oh, makes
yeah.
sense.
Oh, man. This is, yes, we are touching on all of my favorite things. Coffee, no, perfect, Harry Potter, yeah. margaritas. Like,
yeah, man.
Yes. And then this other tattoo, this is actually, it's a milkweed flower. Hmm. And it's a print that I found on my honeymoon with my wife. It's kind of crazy. My wife moved to Nashville in May of 2020. She kind of had this feeling around like February of 2020 that this was where she needed to be to kind of like settle down and like build a life. And she has always used a monarch butterfly as like her spiritual guide. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of led her around a lot of different decisions that she's made. And she ended up coming to Nashville and there was like, you know, she was just visiting for the night. She has her family lives in like Alabama and Georgia. And so she was coming over here the day before like a Christmas vacation kind of trip to Alabama to spend some time with her nieces and her brother. And she found a bunch of like butterfly signs to move here. And so she started looking for jobs and everything. And then the tornado happened and then COVID happened. And then she found a job and she moved here. But you know, our life has been so drastically changed by that decision of her to move here. And I definitely am grateful for that spiritual sign of the butterfly to get her here. But the significance of the milkweed flower is that that is what monarch butterflies migrate to, like, what is it? Like seasonally feed on mm-hmm. milkweed flowers.
Wow.
Which saying it like that sounds weird, like seasonally feed. but like, you know, that causes a migrational pattern for these butterflies.
Yeah. I too like to season my food.
Oh man.
Sorry.
No, that one was good. That was good. I appreciate that. But the reason why this is so significant is because the milkweed flower is native to both Nashville and Athens, Georgia.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
And I didn't know that until I was doing research on what the milkweed flower was. And I had found this print on our honeymoon. We were walking through a town in the mountains of North Carolina called Highlands. And we walked into this really cool boutique store that had like a bunch of like interesting candle designs and really cool like floral arrangements. And we were just like really drawn into the space. And in the back of the entire building, like very back corner, there was just a stack of these like prints. And this was on there. It was the first one. I flipped the page and this was sitting right there looking at me.
Wow.
And it said in the bottom, milkweed. And I was just like, that's interesting. So we grabbed that. I took a picture of it and sent it to Chipper and was like, dude, we got to do this for my next one. So yeah, it's just a nod to my wife and hoping that she stays attracted to me.
Dude, that's beautiful. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I feel like the moment you found out it was native to Athens and here, yeah, it's okay, well, it's got to be.
Yeah, that was the moment where I was like, at first I was like, okay, man, like this is just... I'm kind of skeptical, like milkweed could do something small. Like I didn't want to get like just a butterfly on my arm, you know? Yeah. And I was like, oh no, this is a nod to that. So like, it's nice. a cheeky little thing that draws me back into home here. And you know, there's a whole other slew of reasons about it, but it's cool.
I like that. It's not just the thing. It's part of the relevant ecosystem of the thing.
Yeah.
That's, it's literal reason for
moving.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool, yeah. Man.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm itching to get some more, but these are the only ones I have for now.
Cool. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, man. You guys got any tattoos?
I don't.
I've just got my wedding band,
about it. Yeah.
But I'm going to get.
You are?
Straight up riddled.
Do it.
Riddled.
Yeah, but I just got a few things I got to do to earn it first. Mm.
I feel like I'm not opposed to getting one, especially as a drummer. I think it, you know,
yeah,
maybe this is a dumb reason, but it would just look so cool. Mm. Right. I mean, come on.
That's not a dumb reason. That's one of the best reasons to get one.
That's half the reason why people get tattoos, because they think it would, you know, look cooler or have some sort of impact on their aesthetic.
Yeah.
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 I know what I want. I got a list.
Are you from Grower Sharing?
I'm not. I ain't telling y'all jack about what I'm going to get. I'm just going to get it and you're going to learn.
Yeah, you can tell us after
this. Oh, shit.
Y'all going to learn today. Anyway. Okay. Mm. Well, I think we're wrapping up.
Yeah.
Do you have any final wrap-up questions, Danathan?
That was my question, the tattoo. Do you have one? Danathan? You just combine our names?
Maybe.
You did.
Oh, I did.
I'm not mad about it.
Oh. No. Actually, you kind of answered everything I wanted to ask, but for the people out there, where would you like them to follow you? Preferably not Kroger.
Yeah, not Kroger. I'm on Instagram. It's my name at Alec Parrish with two R's, P-A-R-R-I-S-H. You can find me on Threads, or I guess X is still a thing. I don't really post much. I'm a lurker on those. Instagram's where I spend most of my time. And if you want to connect with me there, that's cool. Or you can check out my website, alecparrish.com, and we can connect through there.
Awesome, man.
Beautiful.
Well, it's great having you on. Yeah, it's great learning your background.
Much. Thank you all so much. It was really fun.
That was a pleasure, man.
Yeah.
Put your hand in my hand. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. If you liked it, please consider leaving us a review on the Apple Podcast app. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you can help support this dream and keep the ball rolling for us. Believe it or not, it's not free or even necessarily cheap for us to make this thing go. To sign up, go to patreon.com/Nashville Drummers Podcast or click the link in our Instagram bio. All of your help is greatly appreciated.
Visit our website, NashvilleDrummersPodcast.com, where you can listen to all past episodes, learn more about myself and Nate, and buy all your favorite Nashville Drummers Podcast merch, including t-shirts, tank tops, sweatshirts, hats, and drumheads. Connect with us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube at Nashville Drummers Podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.